DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hello, I'm Irene Quayle in Bonn. Good to have you with us.
Britons never, never, never shall be slaves.
With the United Kingdom poised to vote on whether to leave the European Union, we'll be taking a look at connections between politics and environmental issues in Britain and elsewhere.
If we are truly to address the challenges of the future, be it climate change, destruction of nature, air pollution, then we need to come together, we need to work together. And I think reducing our voice in the probably the most environmentally progressive grouping of nations in the world would be a negative both for us and globally.
Australia too is gearing up for a vote.
Both major parties, Liberals, Nationals and Labour, are actually ignoring environmental issues as much as they can, as they seem to be difficult and against their other interests. And they also know that only about 15% of the population actually care about climate change or any environmental issues as an important issue for the election.
And political controversy is blowing in the wind in Poland.
Energia wiatrowa jest źródłem ekologicznym, które jednocześnie...
Wind power provides clean energy, but at the same time it requires substantial backup from the conventional energy industry based on hard coal. So we need to maintain a parallel power generating system with the same capacity in case there is no wind.
Chcemy dokonać pewnych zmian.
The government is trying to keep social peace by not declaring that the coal industry in Poland needs very deep restructuring. So this is a very political narrative directed to certain group of voters, miners and energy producers.
How important are climate and the environment to the politicians who rule our planet, and do the voters care? Coming up on Living Planet. June the 23rd is an important day for the UK and the country's partners in Europe. The people of Britain will be voting in a referendum on whether the country should remain part of the European Union or leave it and go it alone. The vote has been preceded by a divisive campaign. Although fears over the economy and migration have dominated the debate between the Leave and Remain camps, there's also been a row over how a so-called Brexit would impact the environment. Many campaigners fear that Britain's coastlines and natural habitats would be worse off without the wary eye of Brussels. But not everyone agrees. Nick Martin has been following the latest developments across the English Channel.
Listening to the Remain camp on the subject of the environment, one might almost come away with the idea that the EU had invented green policy.
Britain's former Environment Minister Owen Paterson giving a speech in London just a few days before the crucial referendum on EU membership. Paterson, who favours a Brexit, where Britain would leave the 28-member bloc, described how the predecessor to the EU, the European Economic Area, sought to have a common set of environmental rules. This was to prevent any one member gaining a trading advantage by maintaining less rigid environment standards. But he said while the policy looked good on paper, it's been impossible to apply the same rules across vastly different environments and terrains.
As an example, European regulation on landfill came about because of justified concerns about groundwater levels in the Low Countries, where it's naturally high. These were not appropriate for the hilly regions of Western and Northern Britain, but that didn't make any difference to the one-size-fits-all mentality in Brussels.
Paterson insisted that the UK had often been an early adopter of progressive environment regulations. But this was dismissed as nonsense by Matthew Spencer, the director of Green Alliance, a London-based environmental campaign group.
Well, that's just not true. I mean, we have been ahead of the curve on one or two things amongst 100 or so areas where we have environmental agreements with Europe. So he has a rather rose-tinted view of what the UK would have done without collaboration and cooperation with our European neighbours.
Earlier this year, Green Alliance, along with several other leading environment groups, issued a warning about the impact a Brexit would have on Britain's natural habitat. It said EU policy had protected the UK's water and air quality, protected wildlife, and set standards for vehicle emissions and consumer goods that have benefited the public and nature. Spencer acknowledged that the EU's positive contribution is not always plain for the eye to see, but one example is enjoyed by holidaymakers every summer.
Britain currently benefits from very high-quality beaches and bathing water, but we've gone through a process of 40 years of being dragged reluctantly to invest in our sewage treatment works. That dragging has largely come from the European Commission overseeing the Bathing Waters Directive, which we agreed to, but were then somewhat reluctant to incur the costs of delivering. Now we see our beaches in fine state and don't regret having spent that money at all, but individual governments have always found it difficult to justify. So it's really helped having a sort of wider agreement across Europe enforced by European law.
Meanwhile, Paterson, who has emerged as a key figure backing Britain leaving the EU, said he had his own experience of Brussels' inflexibility when trying to negotiate reforms to the Common Agriculture Policy, or CAP. At issue was a regulation which came into effect in 2015, which required farmers with more than 75 hectares of arable land to grow three different crops. Paterson said the rule was ridiculed across Europe.
Not only was this wholly unsuitable to the farming industry and landscape of the UK, it was impossible in Andalusia, where only olive trees will grow in July when it's 45 degrees, and likewise in northern Sweden, where only one spruce will grow in January, where it is minus 45 degrees. The UK was consistently outvoted during the CAP negotiations, and we are obliged to accept highly unsatisfactory compromises, which in the case of the three-crop rule are actually damaging to the UK environment.
In financial terms, Brexit campaigners say Britain would save the equivalent of 11 billion euros a year, which it currently pays towards the EU budget. That figure also takes into account of the billions handed back to the country for agricultural subsidies and structural funds for poorer areas. While advocates of Britain leaving insist that farmers and the environment will still be prioritised, Green campaigners are not so sure. Sam Lowe is European Referendum Campaign Manager for Friends of the Earth.
As we've worked together, the Common Agriculture Policy has improved. It's now got Tier 2, which requires farmers to pursue projects, etc., that benefit the environment if they're to get the funding. And I think there's a big question over if British farmers would get subsidised at all. I think the UK Treasury had its way, it would get zero. But for them to survive, of course, they probably do need some. And that all of that would come into question, what those subsidies meant, what they were conditional on. It would all change. And I think there'd just be huge question marks around what this meant for our rural environment and for farming.
If Britain leaves the EU, European treaties provide for 2 years of negotiations of what to put in place of existing agreements. Many experts expect the UK to remain a member of the European Economic Area, striking similar deals to Norway and Switzerland. But nothing is certain at this stage, and Lowe says even this more favourable option would have far-reaching consequences for existing UK environment policy.
The Birds and Habitats Directive specifically would cease to apply, as would the Bathing Water Directives. And the Birds and Habitats Directive offers great protection for nature across Europe, and the Bathing Water Directive has implications for the cleanliness of beaches. And what we've seen from the Leave camp here is that they've been quite specific that they see, especially specifically the Birds and Habitats Directive, as a detriment. It's red tape that they want to get rid of.
But environment groups say the Birds and Habitats Directive has saved many threatened species. They claim the Leave campaign showed its true colours recently, when leaders vowed to do away with the EU's so-called precautionary principle, where decision makers avoid policies that could harm the public or environment. By doing so, Green campaigners say Britain will in future authorise dangerous pesticides. Friends of the Earth spokesman Lowe said Britain must not pull up the drawbridge at a time when urgent, far-reaching decisions need to be taken collectively.
If we are truly to address the challenges of the future, be it climate change, destruction of nature, air pollution, then we need to come together, we need to work together. And I think reducing our voice in the probably the most environmentally progressive grouping of nations in the world would be a negative both for us and globally.
Despite its importance, the consequences of a Brexit for the environment have received little media coverage over the past 4 months. It seems, however they vote, the British electorate will likely cast their ballot without giving the issue a second thought.
Nick Martin reporting. Australia is another country currently in the midst of a campaign, in this case to elect the national government. The ruling Conservative coalition and the centre-left Labour Party opposition appear to be neck and neck. The country has been in the international spotlight a lot recently. The East Coast was devastated by storms and flooding, and the iconic Great Barrier Reef is under a major threat from coral bleaching caused by warming seawater attributed to a combination of the El Niño phenomenon and global climate change. So you might expect these issues to be featuring in the election campaigns. Esther Blank is a journalist based in Sydney. She's here in Bonn at Deutsche Welle's Global Media Forum this week and dropped into the studio earlier. First, I asked her what role climate change and environmental issues are playing in the election.
Not much at all. Both major parties, Liberals, Nationals and Labour, are actually ignoring environmental issues as much as they can, as they seem to be difficult and against their other interests. And they also know that only about 15% of the population actually care about climate change or any environmental issues as an important issue for the election.
That is a devastatingly low number. Why is there so little interest in these issues in Australia?
I think on one hand, it's because there is so much environment. Australians maybe believe that because they have such a huge country with a small population, with lots of sea, beautiful deserts and so on, that they have so much environment that they might not have to worry about it. The other thing is that they are more worried about the economy at the moment, and the economy is demanding more input from industries like resource industry, mining. And that's in strong contrast to the environmental issues. Mining, for example, is one of the issues regarding the Barrier Reef. There are two big mines being planned for the centre of Queensland. They are coal mines. Coal contributes to global warming, which contributes to the warming of the water, which destroys the Barrier Reef. That's completely out of the discussion. The two major parties do not want to touch that because coal exports are so important. Coal also means if they have the two mines, they have to transport the coal from the mines to China and India. And that has to go through the Barrier Reef, and they have to build a new harbour, a coal harbour right in the middle of it, and transport the coal through the reef. That's another threat which nobody wants to tackle because that means stopping the mines, and that's expensive.
So is no one bringing this to the attention of the Australian public?
The Greens are strong on this issue. They plan to protect the environment. They promote a plan to combat climate change. But they reach maybe 11%. They might get about 11% at the election. And according to the Australian electoral system, and the voting system, that does not mean much. They will not be represented very highly in the parliament. If they are lucky at this election and they come out 50-50, the big parties, they might get one or two members of parliament who then could maybe help because they might have a decisive vote. But that's the only thing they can hope for. And the media are not really reporting environmental issues very much either. It's not in the interest of some of the media owners. And there is a certain lack of commitment or interest in covering difficult environmental issues.
Sounds like very bad news. Lucky we have Living Planet. Now, the Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, though, has just pledged $1 billion Australian dollars, or $738 million US, as a fund for the Great Barrier Reef, where the scientists tell us that this mass coral bleaching has already destroyed vast tracts of the World Heritage Site. So is this just a popularity gimmick to attract votes as part of the election campaign, or how does that fit in?
I think it is something to attract votes. It's also because the world has been looking at the Barrier Reef situation, and the Australian government has to do something. But they don't really want to do something which damages either the resource companies or the workers working in this field, or farmers whose runoff and pollution contributes to the Barrier Reef problems, or actually the average person who might have to pay more for energy if they go, for example, for alternative energies, renewables. So this is a plan which combats the deterioration of the water quality by, for example, helping to combat effluent. And they have a couple of research programs and things like that. They contribute to combat the crown of thorns, which is a creature which damages the reef. But this does not include any action about coal mining or the real reason why there is a warming. And if you really wanted to do something about it, experts say, they need at least $16 billion.
Ooh.
This is not $1 billion over 10 years. $16 billion, that's a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned renewable energies. Australia is a continent with almost endless sunshine. So does that translate into widespread use of solar power? Surely that could be a viable alternative to coal.
Yes, and it's not only solar power. Australia has a great wind resource. So that could be an alternative as well. Also, seawater, geothermal, everything you can think of in renewable energy is actually there, a lot of it, and could be used. But that's in competition to the coal industry. And the coal mining and the energy producers who need coal for their old-fashioned plants, they just don't want to give up. And the governments and the opposition party as well are to a certain degree beholden to one of the biggest and most important exports, resources, and also to the workers who work there. The unions want to keep the jobs for their miners, of course, their well-paying jobs. And so this is very hard for any government to do something decisive about this issue without damaging their votes.
At the same time, of course, we have the Paris Climate Agreement, which will only come into effect when it is ratified by a certain number of countries. How is that looking then in Australia with this government, or if there were to be a change of government? Would it make any difference?
It would maybe in the long run. In the short run, Australia has committed to 5% reduction of emissions. 5.5%, that's not very much in comparison to other countries, of course. In the long run, the Liberal Party wants to reduce, that's up to 2030, 2050. The Liberal Party, National Party, would like to reduce emissions by about 25 to 28% based on 2005, which was a very high polluting year. And the Labour Party, however, would like to reduce it by 50% and also plans have zero emissions in the future. But these issues are not really issues debated very hotly at the moment in the election campaign. And they're also very far into the future. So the next government doesn't really have to bother about it very much.
So corals are dying, forest fires are on the increase, there's been unprecedented flooding. What else has to happen to convince Australia that we need urgent action on climate change?
Lots of pressure from overseas, I think, from outside. Of course, people are worried about it. The average person, for example, does put a solar panel on their roof, and people are happy to do that without any support. There's not much support for them at all, and indeed, support for renewable energies and energy sources has been reduced in Australia by several governments in the past. People are interested in this, but they don't really want to commit to anything which costs a lot of money in the future. And I think also maybe parties are underestimating their own voters. I think if people were properly informed, they would probably be ready to make some sacrifices for the greater good to combat climate change, for example. But Australia is also, one expert called it, the center of climate skeptics. There are more climate skeptics in the media in Australia than even in the US.
Esther Blank with another piece of sobering political background, this time from Australia.
Travelling in a freighter combi on a hippie trailhead full of zombies. I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast. She said, do you come from a land down under? A women glow and men blunder. Can't you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover.
unlike Australia, the European Union has been promoting renewable energy sources, encouraging member states to opt for green energy to combat climate change. But the UK's Brexit campaigners, we heard earlier, are not the only ones who object to some of the green policy directives from Brussels. Wind energy has developed tremendously in recent years, but Poland, one of the EU's strongly coal-based economies, seems to be moving backwards. The authorities are introducing tough restrictions on the construction of new wind turbines. Yet the country has a 600-kilometre stretch of windy Baltic Sea coastline where scores of wind turbines have been built in the past two decades. Julian Berner explores the reasons behind the move.
In recent years, clusters of wind turbines have become a common sight in Poland, like here on Mount Kamieńsk, next to a busy motorway in the south of the country. Poland lies in the part of Europe where Atlantic and continental air masses frequently collide, producing unsettled windy weather ideal to set turbine blades in motion. Until now, successive Polish governments have been firmly committed to promoting wind power to meet the EU goal of 19% energy production from renewable sources by 2020. Major Scandinavian and German energy companies have invested heavily in the industry, joined by homegrown companies. Polish inventions in wind power have started to make headlines.
Polish engineers have developed a new way to use turbines to utilize wind energy. Developers say the technology can be used almost anywhere and that it's twice as efficient as traditional propellers.
German utility RWE has invested in a new onshore wind farm in Poland. The 17-megawatt wind farm in Opolenica is RWE's seventh wind power project in
Welcome
Poland.
Welcome to Wysoka Wind Farm in Poland. It contains 21 turbines which produce...
Engineer Waldemar Piskos invented a vertical wind turbine, which has been hailed in Central and Eastern Europe. Commercialized by a Polish company, the design has been used successfully on a number of sites in the region. The inventor says the award-winning idea came to him out of necessity.
My vertical wind turbines met their needs, because they keep going even when the blades of traditional turbines no longer rotate in a light breeze. The idea first occurred to me when I was working at a recycling plant, which kept experiencing power cuts. We needed a reliable power supply, such as wind power, but the plant was situated in an area where lighter winds blew. So I came up with a vertical wind turbine, which also stores electricity.
But here in the windswept Mount Kamieńsk area, plans to add more turbines to the existing wind park have hit a snag. Poland's new government has made an about turn on wind energy. It has decided to impose strict limits on the construction of new turbines. Under new regulations, they need to be spaced out in a way that makes architect Małgorzata Chmiel wonder whether any new wind turbines can be built in Poland at all.
If we draw a circle on a map with a radius 10 times the height of Poland's tallest wind turbine, which is 210 meters, plus the height of the blades, we end up with an area of 10 square kilometers. That's as big as a decent-sized town, and wind turbines would be prohibited in that area. Now, the whole country is dotted with small farms and houses. As an architect and planner, I can tell you it is going to be very hard to find anywhere in Poland where you can put a new wind turbine.
The man behind the new regulations is Energy Minister Krzysztof Tchórzewski. He recently told Parliament that Poland needs to rethink its renewable energy philosophy.
Wind power provides clean energy, but at the same time it requires substantial backup from the conventional energy industry based on hard coal. So we need to maintain a parallel power generating system with the same capacity in case there is no wind. The rest of the time it would be doing nothing. When we build new wind power installations, we also need to develop power plants that burn hard coal to secure reliable power supply levels. Poland needs to change in this respect.
But those involved in the wind power industry believe that what's really at stake here is the future of Poland's powerful coal lobby. In the past 2 decades, it has protested against the closure of inefficient mines in a switch toward cleaner energy, and it views sustainable energy sources as a threat. Wojciech Cetnarski is the president of the Polish Wind Energy Association.
The government is trying to keep social peace by not declaring that the coal industry in Poland needs very deep restructuring. So this is a very political narrative directed to a certain group of voters, miners and energy producers. I think that first our government, they have to learn that nothing happens in isolation. The problem of Polish coal mining sector, this is a global trend, and the same is with the renewable energy. The renewable energy is the global trend, and we are subject to that trend. Our obligation toward European Union are crystal clear, and I think that this is a question of time when the government will realize that this is something we really need to fulfill.
Some 2,000 people took part in a demonstration in Warsaw last month against the wind power bill. MPs, stop tilting at windmills, the banners said. One of the protesters, Marek, is a 22-year-old University of Warsaw student and a green activist. He says he's baffled by the authorities' plans, considering that so much money has been invested in wind power in Poland.
We have seaside of Baltic Sea in Poland. That's why the sea breeze can be really helpful to make energy for Poland. These days, there's a lot of private wind energy companies owned by private investments. Once installed, the facility can go like 20 years and of course more.
Other demonstrators expressed concerns that were more local in nature. Grzegorz Grochocki, the mayor of the locality of Dolice on the windy Baltic coast, explained that wind power installations have been a crucial part of his commune's development plans. Now they are threatened by the new legislation.
In our commune, spatial planning work began 7 years ago to make room for wind turbines. We decided that this was our future. We were planning to build 2 wind farms, which apart from producing clean energy, would also yield 1 million euros of tax revenue a year for the commune, from the lease of the land to the operator. But now, with the new law, the project will most likely be scrapped.
And what about the R&D potential which emerged in Poland during its sustainable energy boom? Wojciech Cetnarski of the Polish Wind Energy Association says Polish innovation-driven companies are bound to suffer.
Creative people need to be in a positive environment to unleash their creativity. If the narrative about renewable energy is as the current government is having, which is this is something expensive, something Poland doesn't need because we've got coal, that wind turbines are harmful for birds, for people, that they are noisy. Obviously, no one with the creative mind would look into it because they would look into something that is more positive and which in official opinions has some future.
Wojciech Cetnarski has publicly branded the government's plans to curb the development of wind power as a case of state protectionism introduced in favor of Polish coal producers. He believes that Brussels could remind Warsaw of its obligation to keep improving its energy mix in line with EU directives it originally agreed to follow when it became a member of the organization 12 years ago. Julian Berner, DW, Warsaw.
And that's it from Living Planet for this week. If you enjoyed the program, you can download episodes or replay them online at dw.com/environment, where you can also read up on some other environment stories in and behind the news. You can also listen to DW Living Planet stories on iTunes and on SoundCloud. We'd be delighted to hear your thoughts and comments by email to livingplanet@dw.com or via Twitter to DW_eco. I'm Irene Quayle. Producing in the studio was Thomas Schmidt. From all of us here in Bonn, until next time, bye for now.